Ekatra Podcast Conversations, for the curious essential knowledge, simplified. Your gateway to essential ideas that matter most. This audio summary has been prepared with the help of Ekatra AI. Welcome to the deep dive. Today we are opening up a book that, well, it's arguably guided more people into a rational consideration of faith than perhaps any other work in the last century. C.S. Lewis's Mere Christianity.
It really is quite something. And it's not just a beloved classic. It's this profound piece of intellectual architecture, you could say. Our mission today is really to walk you through the clear, logical, step-by-step case Lewis built for the Christian worldview, to show why he believed it was the only system that, well, made sense of reality.
Yeah, and what's fascinating right from the get-go is that Lewis doesn't really ask you to feel anything initially. He asks you to think. He jumps straight into tackling that modern assumption that faith is somehow irrational.
Right. He poses the core question that kind of defines the whole project. Is the Christian worldview reasonable? Is it intellectually, you know, tenable?
Maybe cut straight to the chase.
He really does. He speaks directly to the skeptic because he starts not with theology or dogma, but with universal human experiences. Things we all recognize regardless of belief, like our shared sense of moral obligation.
Okay, so before we dive deeper into the book, let's talk a bit about the man himself. Because C.S. Lewis's own story is, well, that was pretty inseparable from the book's persuasive power, isn't it?
Absolutely. Clive Staples Lewis lived 1898 to 1963. He was a genuine intellectual heavyweight, a renowned professor, first at Oxford, then Cambridge, specializing in medieval and Renaissance literature.
We often know him for things like Narnia or the Screwtape Letters.
Sure, the popular stuff. But his day job, his main professional currency,
core of his authority on this particular subject, is that he spent a big chunk of his early life as an intellectual opponent of the very thing he later championed. He was a staunch, very well-read atheist.
That's completely crucial. His conversion story is famous for being, as he put it, a slow, reluctant intellectual surrender. It wasn't some sudden emotional lightning bolt. It was the result of years of philosophical sparring with his peers, J.R.R. Tolkien being a notable one, that sort of forced him to conclude the evidence pointed towards belief.
He famously joked he was dragged kicking and screaming into Christianity.
He did. And that history of skepticism is just vital. Because he walked that path of the non-believer, he really anticipates the objections, the doubts, kind of from the inside.
So when he writes, it doesn't feel like a lecture.
No, not at all. He's reasoning with you almost like a former member of your own camp, using clear logic, plain language, not dense theological jargon.
Okay, let's move on to the book itself then. Its origin story is also pretty unique, and it makes the content incredibly direct.
It really does. Mere Christianity wasn't originally planned as a book. It started as a series of BBC radio talks during World War II.
A time of huge crisis and existential questions.
Exactly. People were desperate for answers, for some kind of solid ground. And Lewis offered them this logical foundation in a time of, well, chaos.
And his aim was very specific. He wanted to present mere Christianity. What did he mean by mere?
He meant stripping away all the secondary differences. You know, the denominational specifics that divide Catholics, Protestants, Orthodox Christians, and focusing only on the foundational shared beliefs common to nearly all of them.
Like finding the common core.
Precisely. He pictured it like a house. The different denominations are the rooms, but he wanted to describe the main hallway, the core structure of belief itself, where everyone who identifies as Christian could essentially meet.
And the book follows this really clear, logical progression. You called it a staircase of arguments.
Yeah, that's a good way to put it.
Yeah.
He starts right on the ground floor of just basic human reality, asking us to acknowledge this innate moral law, what he calls the law of human nature.
Okay, step one.
Then the argument climbs to the next step. If there's this universal binding law, doesn't that imply there must be a lawgiver, a personal moral God, separate from the universe itself?
Got it. Law implies lawgiver.
Then, once that idea of God is on the table, the staircase leads up to the specific claims Christianity makes about this lawgiver, centering everything on Jesus Christ.
And the final stage.
The final stage is the jump from just belief to actual behavior. How does this belief change you? It moves towards the complete transformation needed to become what Lewis calls the new men.
All right, let's climb that staircase then. Starting with book one. Right and wrong as a clue to the meaning of the universe. This is where he brings in that really crucial idea, the law of human nature.
Yes. And he starts with something everyone gets. arguments, quarrels. When you argue about fairness, you always appeal to some kind of standard, don't you? That's not fair. Or how would you like it if someone did that to you?
Mm-hmm.
Lewis points out that we inherently expect others to recognize this standard, even though, ironically, we constantly fail to live up to it ourselves.
But hang on, isn't that just, you know, good manners or maybe cultural norms we absorb, like knowing which side of the road to drive on? Why does Lewis think this moral law points to something bigger than just social custom?
Good question. That's exactly where he tackles the common objections. First, he looks at the idea of herd instinct. He argues that our sense of duty, the moral law, often requires us to override our strongest instincts like self-preservation to do the right thing. So duty can't just be an instinct.
Right. Sometimes doing the right thing is the hardest thing instinctually.
Exactly. Then second, he addresses social convention. He agrees that, yes, some things are just convention, like fashion or traffic laws. But he points out that fundamental moral principles, like, say, selfishness is wrong or bravery is good, are surprisingly universal across cultures and history. They aren't arbitrary, like which fork to use.
So the moral law isn't just local custom. It feels more like a universal truth, like mathematics.
Sort of, yes. It's a massive objective clue. If the universe were just random matter, just atoms bumping around by chance, why would it contain this insistent command about how we ought to behave?
It doesn't really fit the purely materialist picture.
Not easily. This law suggests some kind of intelligence, a mind or a power behind the universe, not just chance.
Okay, that makes sense. But book one ends on a bit of a downer note, doesn't it?
It does, rather. The uncomfortable conclusion is, okay, if we accept there's a law and therefore a lawgiver, we immediately run into a problem. We know the law, but we break it. All the time. Daily.
We fail to meet the standard we expect others to meet.
Precisely. And that realization means, as Lewis puts it, we have cause to be uneasy.
Right. And that unease, that sort of moral gap, leads us straight into book two, What Christians Believe. This is where Lewis starts to define the kind of God who might have issued this moral law.
Yeah, he makes a crucial distinction early on. He contrasts pantheism, the idea that God is just an impersonal force, basically identical with the universe. Everything is God with theism.
And theism is?
Theism holds that God is a personal, conscious being, separate from the universe he created, and importantly, definitively good or righteous.
And Lewis argues the moral law points towards theism.
Yes, because the law itself feels intensely personal. You ought to do this, and it's concerned with good and evil. So he reasons it must come from a personal good lawgiver, not just an impersonal life force.
Okay, now we get to maybe the most famous part of the book for many people, the bit that really challenges the intellectual skeptic. Lewis introduces what he calls the shocking alternative, the trilemma.
Ah, yes, the liar, lunatic, or Lord argument. This really cuts to the heart of the matter regarding Jesus.
Explain that. What's the core logic?
Lewis looks at the absolutely staggering claims Jesus made about himself. Claims to forgive sins, which implies he's the one sinned against, namely God. Claims to be the eternal judge of humanity. Claims to have existed forever.
Pretty radical claims.
Hugely radical. So Lewis argues, look, given those claims, you simply cannot put Jesus in the comfortable, easy category of just being a great moral teacher, like Socrates or Buddha.
Why not? People say that all the time.
Because a mere human moral teacher wouldn't make claims like that. If someone today went around saying they could forgive your sins against someone else, or that they were the eternal judge, you wouldn't say, oh, what a wise teacher. You'd think they were either deliberately deceiving people.
A liar.
Or that they were dangerously deluded.
A lunatic.
Exactly. Lewis says those are the only logical options if Jesus wasn't actually who he claimed to be. The one option Jesus didn't leave open, according to Lewis, was just being a nice, wise human teacher.
So liar, lunatic, or the third option.
Or Lord. That he actually was God incarnate, who he claimed to be. It forces you off the fence. You have to make an intellectual choice based on his claims.
It's a powerful piece of reasoning.
Yeah.
And if the conclusion is Lord, that leads into explaining the purpose of his death, the atonement.
Right. And Lewis, again, avoids overly complex theology. He often uses a kind of legal or debt metaphor. Humanity, through its constant breaking of the moral law, its moral rebellion, has run up this huge debt.
A debt we can't pay back ourselves.
Precisely. Christ, being both fully God, so having the authority, and fully human, so able to represent us, the perfect member of the species, is uniquely qualified to settle that account. He acts as the perfect penitent on our behalf, satisfying the demands of the moral law we broke.
Okay, so books one and two lay the logical foundation for belief. Then book three shifts gears into Christian behavior. And I love the analogy he uses here. It shows morality isn't just about ticking off don't do this boxes.
That's the brilliant analogy of the fleet of ships, isn't it?
Yeah.
He says, for the fleet's journey to be successful, three things have to be right. First, the ships mustn't collide or get in each other's way. That's social morality, how we treat each other.
Makes sense. Harmony within the fleet.
Second, each individual ship needs to be seaworthy. Its internal machinery, its engine, its steering, everything has to be working properly. That's personal morality, cultivating virtues within ourselves.
Right, keeping your own ship in order.
And the third thing, which he stresses is absolutely crucial, is that the entire fleet has to be heading to the right destination. What's the overall purpose of human life?
Ah, so it reframes morality. It's not just random rules. It's like the instruction manual for making the human machine work properly and head in the right direction.
Exactly. It's about function and purpose. And within that personal morality part, keeping the ship seaworthy, he singles out one particular problem as the great sin.
Which is?
Pride. But he's very careful to define it. It's not just self-respect or liking yourself. Lewis defines pride as a fundamentally competitive vice.
Competitive? How so?
The pleasure of pride, he says, doesn't come simply from having something. It comes from having more of it than the next person. More intelligence, more looks, more wealth, more piety even. It's comparison-based.
Wow, that really clarifies why it's considered so destructive. It sets you inherently against others and ultimately against God because you're constantly trying to be the center.
That's the core of it. It demands you be the focus. And interestingly, he applies similar practical logic to the virtue of charity or agape love.
How does he approach that?
He argues it isn't primarily a feeling you have to conjure up. It's a committed act of the will, choosing to seek the good of others, regardless of how you feel about them.
So you don't have to like someone to be charitable?
Not initially, no. Lewis suggests that if you consistently act charitably, if you practice loving actions, quite often the feeling, the emotional warmth and affection, will follow later. It's very practical. Act the way you ought to, and your feelings might eventually catch up.
Act first, feel later. That's a very actionable approach.
Yeah.
And that practical focus kind of sets us up for book four, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Beyond Personality, which gets into some pretty dope theology, like the Trinity. But again, he uses a wonderfully clear analogy.
He does the analogy of making and begetting.
Right.
Think about it. A sculptor makes a statue in the image of a man, but a man begets a son, and the son shares the same human nature as the father.
Okay. Makes sense.
Lewis uses this to explain the relationship within the Godhead. Humans are made in God's image, like the statue. But Christ, the Son, is begotten of the Father, meaning he shares the very same divine nature eternally.
So it helps explain how Christ can be both distinct from the Father and yet fully God.
Exactly. It points towards the idea that God isn't just a single static person, but something more complex, more dynamic a relationship. He calls the inner life of the Trinity something like a divine dance of love.
A divine dance. I like that. And believers are invited into this.
That's the ultimate goal, what he calls the good infection. The whole point of the Christian life, for Lewis, isn't just moral improvement. It's being drawn into that divine life, that dance, becoming, as he puts it, little Christs, through a complete spiritual transformation.
That's the making of the new man he talks about.
That's it. It's about becoming a fundamentally different kind of being, sharing in God's own life.
Lewis really had an incredible knack for taking these profound theological concepts and boiling them down into memorable, accessible language. So thinking about the whole book, what are some of the core themes or maybe rhetorical insights that really stick with you?
Well, I think the most fundamental thing is how Lewis grounds everything in common human experience. That universal moral law we talked about, that's the anchor for the whole argument.
It's not abstract philosophy. It's something we feel every day.
Exactly. It's part of our psychology. And because of that, Lewis argues believing in a moral God isn't some irrational leap in the dark. It's actually a rational necessity to make sense of that experience.
And his way of arguing forces a kind of intellectual honesty, doesn't it? Like that trilemma.
Oh, definitely. It completely avoids that easy, slightly patronizing dismissal of Jesus as just a wise man. As Lewis famously wrote, you can't just call him a great moral teacher. He didn't leave that option open. He must be a lunatic, a liar, or Lord.
Yeah, that quote really shuts down the comfortable middle ground, the fence sitting.
It forces a decision. And another theme that really transforms how you see yourself and others is his definition of pride.
The competitive aspect.
Yes. That quote is chillingly accurate. Pride gets no pleasure out of having something, only out of having more of it than the next man. When you start applying that lens to your own thoughts and feelings, well, you realize how much daily dissatisfaction comes purely from that competitive comparison, not from genuine lack or need.
It's quite convicting, actually. And if we shift to practical application, Lewis gives us some real tools for everyday life, doesn't he? I find his point about forgiveness incredibly helpful for dealing with, you know, difficult relationships.
Absolutely. That distinction he makes is key. Forgiveness is primarily an act of the will. It's deciding to let go of resentment, to stop wishing ill on the person, maybe even to wish them well. It's separate from your emotions.
So you don't have to feel forgiving to actually forgive.
Precisely. You might still feel hurt, angry, betrayed, but you can still choose to forgive in the sense Lewis means letting go of the right to get even, canceling the debt, so to speak. This makes forgiveness possible even when the feelings aren't there yet.
It turns forgiveness into a discipline, something you do rather than a feeling you wait for. I also really appreciate his underlying emphasis on intellectual humility throughout the book.
Yes, the whole book is an exercise in following an argument logically, wherever it leads. It encourages us, whether we start as believers or skeptics, to examine our own assumptions honestly.
A good practice for anyone, really.
Definitely. And one more practical thing, his let's pretend principle for personal growth. It's a fantastic insight into habit formation.
How does that work?
He suggests that you should start acting like the person you want to become. Act with patience, even if you feel impatient. Act with charity, even if you don't feel charitable. At first, it might feel like pretending, like wearing a mask.
Like fake it till you make it.
Kind of, but deeper. Lewis believed that by consistently practicing the outward actions of virtue, you are actually cooperating with God's grace, allowing him to gradually transform your inner disposition. What starts as an external act can, over time, become an internal reality. It turns morality into less of a grim test of willpower and more like a practical training program for the soul.
That's a much more hopeful way to look at personal change. Okay, as we wrap up this deep dive into mere Christianity, what was maybe the most surprising thing for you or the insight that resonates most powerfully?
For me, I think it's his unique role as a bridge builder. He stands so firmly with one foot in the world of rigorous intellect and the other in the world of profound faith.
Yeah, he connects those two worlds.
He really does. He demonstrates, or tries to demonstrate, that faith isn't a retreat from thinking. For him, it was the culmination of it. He gives the rational, perhaps skeptical reader this comprehensive, logical framework, arguing that the Christian story is the one that actually makes the most coherent sense of the world, especially that stubborn moral law we all experience.
That's a great point. And I think my lasting takeaway is how he completely reframes the goal of Christianity. It's not fundamentally about just following rules to earn a ticket to heaven or even just about self-improvement.
It's bigger than that.
Much bigger.
Yeah.
It's presented as this grand invitation into a transformative reality. It's like the demolition of the old faulty self and the building of something entirely new, participating in the very life and nature of God, becoming those new men. That's a radical vision.
A powerful ending to a powerful book indeed. If you're looking for a challenging yet remarkably clear and logical introduction to the Christian worldview, Lewis really remains, well, pretty much the undisputed champion, I'd say.
Couldn't agree more. See you next time with another remarkable thinker, another powerful book, and another idea that has shaped our world. This audio summary is brought to you by Akatra Foundation.